At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcasts12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcasts12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcasts12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcasts12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcasts12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcasts12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Today on The Grave Talks, Life in the Morgue. Lance Anderson grew up in a haunted house. Night after night, he and his siblings would hear and see spirits lingering in their home, even though their parents refused to believe or accept these occurrences as fact. Lance knew better. Later in life, Lance's curiosity about the paranormal would take him on investigations and even lead him into a career that dealt with the dead on a daily basis. The morgue. The morgue is a place where the living don't often find themselves unless, of course, their life has ended. Sometimes it seems the bodies that would enter the morgue didn't seem to understand that their time with the living was over. This is the story of a haunted life. The haunted life of Lance Anderson.
Yeah, I grew up in what I consider a very haunted house. when my parents bought the house that we moved into, I was probably 5 or 6 years old when we moved in there. And I remember doing the walkthrough with my parents and my older brother. He's 2 years older than me. And we both refused to go into the basement or up into the attic. Even as kids, there was just something about the house.
You know, that's a kind of a common thing, even without ghosts, for kids to be like, I'm not going to go in the basement, I'm not going to go in the attic, just the stigma of what those places are. Typically, dark, secluded areas that don't really feel like the rest of the home. What was it for you that when you look back on this, that makes you go, you know, I think that was more than just childhood fear that I had going on there?
I had several experiences in the house while I was growing up. And so did my brother and three younger sisters.
Let's talk about some of those.
Okay. I was going to say my parents denied anything ever happened in the house. But as we were growing up, like I said, I was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old when we moved in there. 4 or 5 years after we moved in, my mother got pregnant. And there was a two-family house that they had bought. And the upstairs was empty. They never rented it out. So they decided to move me in my brother's bedrooms upstairs. And almost from the first night, you'd hear noises and stuff coming from the, you know, the empty half of the house. We just had the two front rooms. and you'd hear noises coming from the empty half of the house. And, you know, you tell your parents about it, and it's squirrels or, you know, some critters in there or whatever, and they'd always go look, and there was nothing in there. The other half of the house was completely empty, not a box or anything in there, and you hear stuff being dragged around. And got to a point where actually started hearing a voice coming from the other room, like he was trying to talk. So being, you know, I was probably 10, 11 years old at this point, and starting to hear voices and stuff out there. I ended up bribing my brother to switch rooms so I could be on the furthest end of the house away from the empty part to switch rooms with me. And we did that. And there was one night, the heater in my room kept getting turned all the way up, and my parents would start yelling about the gas bill. It happened 2 or 3 months in a row, and they were still complaining about, they were accusing me basically of cranking up the heat, and my bedroom would be like 90 degrees in the morning. Mm-hmm. So they come up and took the dial off the heater, so you couldn't adjust it unless you had a pair of pliers. And then there was one particular night that I was up there sleeping, and I was hearing voices and stuff being moved around and like footsteps over my head up in the attic, and saw this apparition of a little boy or a young boy kind of float by the heater. And I had nowhere to go. I couldn't get out the room. So I just kind of huddled up in my bed, and I'm like, "Who are you? What do you want?" And he just looked at me and said, "I'm cold," and then disappeared. So the long-winded version of this story is I ended up moving when I went to high school. I went to an agricultural high school. So I ended up moving onto a dairy farm, and I came home every other weekend. So at that point, I was just kind of couching it downstairs and never really discussed anything else with my younger sisters about this. And, you know, several years later, I was at my niece's sweet 16 party, and we're sitting at this table and we're talking ghosts. And my sister comes up and she goes, "Oh, you're talking about Danny?" And I'm like, "Danny, who's Danny?" And she goes, "Oh, he's the little boy ghost that lives in mom's house." And I'm like, "You've seen him?" And she's like, "Yeah, we've all seen him. Everyone knew he was there."
With the little boy apparition that you saw plain as day, your siblings, you're finding that everybody had seen them. When this was going on, when you were little and you were seeing these things, What was going through your mind? Were you accepting that this is a ghost? How was your mind processing it at the time?
To be honest, I don't know. I really thought there was someone living in the other half of the empty house.
Yeah.
I really did. I mean, I was terrified by the whole thing. I remember sitting in my bed just being absolutely terrified because I couldn't get to the door the way he had floated in the room. That was the first time I had seen him, so...
After all this had gone on and your parents, as you were experiencing these things and giving the excuses of squirrels or you name it, once everyone was a bit older and everyone is able to recount these things as happening and not being just a childhood fantasy or some dream that maybe you misconstrued with reality, were you ever able to talk to your parents about it again and or everyone bring it up and get any sort of feedback?
No, my parents, denied it right up until the end. despite all my brothers and sisters saying they've seen stuff and they've, you know, the majority, like I said, I'm pretty sure all of my siblings have seen the little boy himself. So
do you, when you look back on this, just as an adult retrospectively, kind of putting all the pieces together, do you believe that they don't believe, or that your parents did not believe in this stuff happening? Or do you wonder if maybe they had experiences and sometimes that's the defense mechanism that many people have of just, nope, just kind of shutting it down, not talking about it, not accepting it. Or do you think maybe it never came to them?
Well, I have one theory of maybe he only appeared to other kids.
Okay.
But I have had the thoughts that my parents' denial right up until the end was probably a little on the false side. I don't see how they could have not known.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're thinking you have squirrels or raccoons in your house, you'd get some kind of animal control or exterminator or.
You would think.
That never happened. So
there's many things I look back on as an adult and I go, well, if that was what the reason was, why the hell didn't they do B? Step two would be this, but this was like never done. This doesn't make any sense. As an adult, this would be the correct response to said problem. The little boy apparition that you saw there and that everyone had seen in the house. I know you've done some investigation work as an adult. Were you ever able to do any sort of investigating into who that little boy might be?
We did do some research on it, me and my brother, and it was found out that, well, the house was built in 1912. It was found out there was a little boy there. He was 12 years old, and he was kind of known in the neighborhood as Danny the Milkman because he'd help the milk guy deliver milk. Mm-hmm. And this is where the story takes quite a twist. Danny was ice skating on one of the canals in the city and fell through the ice and drowned. So
wow,
that's what we found out about Danny. And that happened in like 1943, I think it was.
Sure. How old was, I'm assuming that this was an older house?
Yeah, the house was built in 1912.
Okay. So obviously quite a history there to it. So as an adult, you grew up in a haunted house. This is just kind of a fact of life for you of these things happen. These things exist. You've experienced them firsthand. Some, family members also experienced them firsthand. So it wasn't like, well, I know other people out there might. These are people who, their family that have also gone through very similar things. What was your interest in the paranormal as an adult? It was other than knowing that these things happened to you. Did you have a desire to learn more or to investigate other locations that may be haunted?
I had a big desire to investigate other locations. I did want to see more, and I knew if, Danny was in my mother's house, that there would be others somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Was it a curiosity for you of almost validating that these experiences happened by having more experiences, or was there any sort of goal in mind what was your goal in mind ultimately when going out and trying to do some investigating?
That's probably the best way to put it. Is it was just trying to validate what I had seen.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Like I said, I mean, when I, like I said, when I was 14 and I went to this agricultural high school, I wasn't really living at home. And when I came home every other weekend, I'd be hanging out with my friends and stuff. I really wasn't hanging around with my siblings. My brother had his own friends and my sisters obviously had their own friends. Mm-hmm. And I had my own friends. It was kind of a neighborhood thing. Yeah. So we never really sat there around as kids and discussed this.
Yeah.
But when I was in high school, right across one of the hay fields was Danvers State Hospital, which was an abandoned asylum. And we used to quite frequently after, class, go through the building until we got caught. Not recommended to trespass.
No, not at all. But obviously, state hospitals, when they're abandoned, the architecture of them, the history of them, leaves much to be desired in terms of how a lot of people were taken care of. I don't know the specific history of that, but just kind of speaking in general terms, things in state hospitals, the ways and methods and means of taking care of people at an earlier point in time. Nowhere near the standards of today. Some were much better than others, but in almost every case, some arcane methods compared to what we would be doing today for caring for folks that would be in a care facility like that. So that in mind, and then just the energy that is attached to some of those places. When you were wandering through those locations out of curiosity, was it an investigation, or was it more so kind of teenage exploration into a creepy building?
It was teenage exploration into a creepy building, but I did have a big, one of those big old fashioned square cassette recorders.
Okay.
That I did take in with me a couple of times. Never really got any voices. maybe a couple of possible moans and a lot of door slamming, but never really any voices on it.
No, just
I still was taped somewhere too.
But you were going in with more equipment than most, as far as teenagers just exploring a creepy location. Did you do any other investigating work as you got older?
Well, just as an afterthought on that, the only reason I even knew to bring a cassette recorder in is because I had watched that show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Sure.
and they had a ghost hunter or a paranormal investigator on there who was using a cassette recorder. That's the only reason I even thought of bringing that in there that day.
Way before the world of ghost adventures and all of that. Yes.
Way before. Yeah.
Yep.
As far as when I was growing up, I mean, after high school, it kind of faded out. In my 20s, I wasn't doing much of anything. I wasn't researching anything. And then, my mid-30s, my oldest stepdaughter said, "Hey, there's this paranormal group." I mean, she knew I liked paranormal stuff. I was watching paranormal themed movies and shows all the time. And she said, "There's a paranormal group doing a presentation at the library in town." She says, "You want to go see it with me?" So we went, and then I enjoyed the presentation. I started talking to these people, and before you know it, I was invited on a couple of local ghost hunts and ended up joining the team. And the rest is history, as they say. That was about 10, 12 years ago, and now I am co-founder of my own team. And
so when you started going out onto ghost hunts as an adult and seeing it from that perspective, What were your expectations at that point? It'd been a while since the childhood experiences. You'd watched a lot of television and movies and seeing what that is, but I'm sure you know how overblown some of those things can be. What was it like as far as when you began doing some investigative work as an adult on a more serious level?
As an adult more seriously, it really, I guess the best way to describe it is kind of an adrenaline rush, because it's, you know, I really wanted something to happen. You know, I wanted something to happen. I wanted to have that picture or that piece of video or that recording. Like I said, I guess I'm still looking for the validation. I mean, I've had plenty of experiences now, so I'm pretty validated in my own beliefs. But, you know, when it's all starting out, it's, I just want that validation. I want the proof. And it's kind of an adrenaline rush when something happens.
Tell me about some of the times that stand out to you the most from the investigating work as an adult, where you feel you got that proof, where you were, what you were doing, what happened.
Well, no doubt in my mind on what story that one is. That's the, there's a fairly local place, a couple of towns over. It was called Bucco's Tavern. It was built in the mid to late 1700s, one of the oldest buildings in that town. And it was kind of used for everything from, I think it started out as a grain mill and then became a tavern and a post office and just short of becoming a meeting house. And now it was a bar and restaurant and bar. And we were going in there with the group, and the group had a medium. This was my second or third time in this building, as far as, you know, an investigation. And we had a medium with us on this particular night, and she wanted to do a building walkthrough. So I went in with her, and we're walking around downstairs, and she just kept going on with, you know, there's a man following us, and he's not really happy we're here. She says, he's not threatening, but he's just not happy. And we're walking through the building, we did the whole downstairs, and she stopped at the stairs that were going up to the second floor. Now, the second floor itself is interesting because there's an apartment up there, and it was abandoned by whoever lived in there. They left everything, clothing, electronics. There were still dishes on the table, and they just got up and took off. The new building owner had no idea who the people were or why they took off. But we're standing at the bottom of the stairs, and she's like, he's going to be really angry if we go upstairs. And so she stopped and she did a little prayer to call in, you know, some angels for protection. And she, you know, she's doing all that. And we worked our way up to the top of the stairs and we're standing on the landing. She stopped at the top of the stairs. I walked about 8 to 10 feet down over to this apartment door. and I was standing there at the apartment door. In between us now is the stairs that go up into the attic of this building. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing at the apartment door, and she's, "Don't open that door." And I'm like, "Okay, why?" I says, I really wanted you to see this particular section of the building." And she's like, "Yeah, don't open that door." She says, "He's right here, and he's really angry that we're about to go in there." And I'm like, "Okay, well, where is he? Where's right here?" She's like, "I don't know. He's not showing himself, but he's right here." So I'm like, "Okay, what do you want me to do?" She's like, "Come back over here with me." She says, I got to sort this out in my head. So I turned around to start walking back to her. And just as I got to the edge of the stairs going up into the attic, I saw a man standing on the stairs. This is about the best way to describe it. He was a very solid man, and, you know, it was kind of dark, but there was a guy standing on the stairs just staring at me. So I think I said a bad word and almost ran the medium over, and she screamed. And she's like, "What's going on?" And I'm like, "He's right there on the stairs." And she's like, "Well, go over and talk to him." And I'm like, "You go talk to him. You're the medium." But after, you know, a couple of seconds, we calmed ourselves down, regained our composure, and kind of went around to the attic stairs. And obviously he was gone at that point. We went up into the attic and couldn't find him again. But it's kind of interesting because his backstory on this building is there was a girl that was on our ghost hunting team that used to be a bartender slash waitress there mm-hmm. years ago. And there was a man, well, his first name was Paul, and he was from Switzerland. And it was his big thing to, it was his big dream to open a restaurant in this country. And so when he opened it, it was called the Swiss House. That's when that woman was working there. And he had died in his late 30s of chicken pox, of all things.
Wow.
Because he wasn't immunized from chicken pox. Mm-hmm. And now this happened probably 2012, 2013 that I saw the apparition. And it was 2 years ago, me and a few members of my team went to another group's paranormal presentation, and he uses a medium. And it turns out that they went to that same building, and the medium was up there telling the story about this guy. And she described exactly what I saw as far as what this guy looked like. And but she was saying, you know, she said, you know, he was foreign. So she had trouble understanding him when he was trying to communicate because he was a foreigner, and et cetera, et cetera. So I went up and talked to her after, and we kind of validated each other's stories. She described exactly what he looked like, exactly what I saw. And then I told her the backstory about, well, I was told he was from Switzerland and this was his big thing. And she was like, "Yeah, and he died of something he shouldn't have died from." And I'm like, "Well, he died of chicken pox, which is kind of rare these days." Mm-hmm. But the chicken pox, you know, caused some fever. He didn't die in the building, but his fever got so high, he got rushed to a hospital and died at a hospital. But
yeah,
that was his dream to have that building.
And it sounds like he's still there. When you have something like that, this is really an opinion-based question, but when you have someone who passes and they seem to be haunting a single building, sometimes it makes a lot of sense where it's, oh, this is the dream. It was to have that building. So it makes sense that they are there. But sometimes you run into haunting cases where you don't know why. Why would this person still be at this location when it really, you know, it was not their dream to be there? It was not anything really. It was just kind of something maybe in their life, something maybe not even in their life. Why are they in certain locations? When it comes to the geography of where ghosts seem to frequent, do you think there's any boundary rules that they follow, or is it a lot of free will?
Boy, that's a good question. I think it's kind of a free will as far as the entity is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Like they may, you know, like you said, it might not be their dream, but they may choose a location. I don't know, maybe because of the environment, maybe they're comfortable there. Maybe there's a certain energetic vibe that mm-hmm. they can deal with or they like, I don't know. That's a really good question. I do think they have free will. I find it hard to believe that an entity will be stuck in a particular building and can't get anywhere else.
Sure.
So
I think it's interesting, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about some more of your investigative work here a little bit later on in the conversation. You had an interesting career change at one point in your life, but moving on from being an iron worker into going and taking a job at the medical examiner's office in a morgue, essentially. Let me ask you, I mean, that's quite an interesting job change. And when you see job at the morgue, I don't know that a lot of people are like, ooh, sign me up. What was it for you that made you decide to get into that area?
You know, honestly, I don't know. My only motivation for the career change was working in construction in New England. There's not a lot of work in the winter.
Sure.
Sometimes you get lucky and you get, year-round work. And it was to a point where I needed, more of a steady income. I'd work 2 days and then be off 3 days and then work 3 days and be off 4 days. Mm-hmm. So it was, on my downtime, I was working for a demolition company, actually. Mm-hmm. And they had a job in Portland tearing down a mental hospital, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
They had a job in Portland. So I took the layoff from ironworking and I was working for them. And I'd get sent to Portland on early Monday morning and come back Friday nights. And, being young, married, I had two stepdaughters and my son. So it was, it was kind of a strain to be out of town and just coming home on weekends. Mm-hmm. So I was really just looking for like a state job or something that I knew was going to be steady. Mm-hmm. So I was going through, websites and all the local channels and stuff. And there was one website that was listing state jobs. And that one kind of jumped right out at me. It was an entry level position and the job requirements were a driver's license and a high school diploma. So
what was the job description exactly?
The job description was incredibly lengthy. But all I really got out of it was, one of the things was assisting the medical examiner, which I did not think meant during an autopsy. But the way I read the job description, it was basically, you're driving around in a state truck to these accident scenes or whatever, or scene of death, and, you bring the body back to the office. And as it turns out, it was a whole lot more than that.
Yeah. So you take this job. What is it? What's it like? I mean, obviously there's the what's it like question of just non-paranormal of what is it like doing this job? Let's start there before we get into some of your first experiences that you had on that job that involved the not so living. What was it feeling like just getting into the job itself and the non-supernatural answer to that question?
Getting into the job itself was actually pretty nerve-wracking. It's kind of one of the reasons that I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. It was a very fast-paced environment, for a lot faster pace than what I thought it was going to be. My first day, the guy that was training me basically told me, try not to ask too many questions because you'll agitate people. This is one of the only places that eats its own young. And, after a few more days, it really was, this place is a book or a movie, because you can't believe the stuff that happens in the building itself and the cases that were coming in.
Are you just
the people that were working there.
When you say you can't believe the stuff that happens, are you referring to things that are paranormal or things that other humans are doing to other humans that are alive?
I described it before as man's inhumanity to man.
Give us some examples of that.
one of my first dealings was there were two homeless men that were living under a bridge abutment. They had a little makeshift shelter. Mm-hmm. And some woman trying to be nice gave one of them a hatchet so they could chop up firewood to keep warm. Mm-hmm. And it didn't take more than 3 days. They were both murdered with the hatchet.
Wow.
And we had to pick them up. That was, you know, one of my first experiences. But, I mean, there's tons of tragic cases. I mean, the, mm-hmm. the shootings and stabbings and
sure.
Multiple homicides and murder-suicides. And
so was it part of your job to physically move the body from its place of where the individual died or was murdered, yes, or whatever, and get it onto the gurney and then get it into the vehicle and get out of there?
Yes, that was part of the job.
So then you were exposed to seeing these scenes after the investigators and everything had said, okay, you can take the body now.
Absolutely.
That had to have been incredibly taxing, I would think. I mean, unless you have a lot of experience here seeing dead bodies on a regular basis that you didn't share. But if this is not a normal thing for you, I would think that would be a very emotionally taxing thing, having to suddenly make this part of your life of seeing those scenes on a regular basis.
I say it all the time. I'm sure I have some form of PTSD or something. I mean, there's, you know, sure. there's images and there's scenes that I just, that are never going to leave my head.
Sure.
So
did they prepare you for this at all with the job, or was it more trial by fire? Hey, there's some pickup over at 34th and Elmore. Go get it. Almost as if you're picking up P.F. Chang's for someone with Grubhub, but you're picking up a body.
There was no preparation. No. There really wasn't. It would be, you know, when a case got called in, and you know, cases were called in and they were prioritized, and it's like, okay, well, you got to go to this car accident here, and you know, while you're out at the car accident, you might have something else come in. You might have, you know, a suicide over. You know, 30 miles away. I almost said 300.
Yeah.
That's one of the highlights of the book is you really don't know what you're walking into.
Yeah.
Basically, you just don't know.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Lance Anderson about his haunted life and life in the morgue. We'll continue our conversation in part two. We'll ask about a body that came into the morgue that wasn't quite right. Who was the ghost that haunted the decomposing room at the morgue? What other spirits lingered inside the morgue, and what did they want? And what shocking scene of death did Lance walk into that he knew held spirits? Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Stephen at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Stephen.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.